This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
This audio file contains the response by Jonathan Perriton to the talk by Jesper Jespersen at the Keynes Seminar on 23rd of November 2010.
Okay, thanks very much. I've got fewer slides. I didn't want to duplicate too much of the material that Jesper had already gone over. We discussed beforehand that about 4 years ago we were on a panel session about unemployment in Europe, and Jesper announced at the end of my paper that he wished to make it clear he disagreed with all the three conclusions. We've kind of lost sight over the intervening 4 years of exactly what the traces of the disagreement was. Maybe it will occur again. One perhaps interesting way of starting looking at these economies is that until recently there was a sort of official mainstream view that the Anglo-Saxon model was the way to go, and most of the literature was rather critical of the Scandinavian economies and a belief that their systems were not sustainable. The arguments vary. Sometimes it was simply a case of saying high taxation social security systems like this just not sustainable in a globalised world for straightforward competitiveness reasons. Other versions were a bit more nuanced than that. Both the welfare state but also the relatively egalitarian income distribution that Jesper has highlighted were supposed to be detrimental to performance at both the top and the bottom ends. The argument in some versions being at the top end you need to allow wages to rise to encourage the high-end workers to specialise in the global economy and high-end production, and at the other end that the way to generate jobs amongst the least skilled was to allow wages to fall to generate low-skilled private sector services jobs that allegedly had been done in Anglo-Saxon economies. And the pressures to ensure that wage differentials didn't increase, and particularly didn't increase at the bottom end, in the Scandinavian model, were supposed to be held to inhibit employment creation amongst low-skilled, low-educated workers in the private services sector. This was very much the story that was propounded in various circles. And that story has hit problems to such an extent that it's also been quasi-acknowledged, sort of acknowledged in some sort of official circles. I think there are real and perhaps slightly less real problems with that story. The real problem is being, I think, there are important ways which just doesn't fit the facts, given quite decent employment performance we've already seen in Scandinavian economies. They're sort of less quotes real things, in that official agencies like the OECD and a variety of more mainstream economists have had concerted efforts to explain unemployment in terms of institutions, things like unemployment benefit levels, the legal restrictions, the power of trade unions, and so on. And there's a sort of real, in inverted commas, problem in sense with that. It's not what you get in sort of OECD documents often in this is the front page says a clear labour market flexibility story is the way to boost employment. Then if you look in the detail of the report, it's a kind of, well, we ran some econometric numbers, I'll squint and look at it in the right light, and it sort of gives the right answer. But in a way, in a sense, if you take something that fluctuates and varies a lot over time, like unemployment, and even the order of countries, you know, there are periods in which some countries are above average performers that subsequently become below average performers. It's not even sort of the rankings, not even that necessarily that consistent over time. If that's your variable, you're explaining that's variable, and you explain it in terms of institutional variables like the tax system, the unemployment benefit rate, the legal and trade union position, which don't vary a great deal over time, it's not surprising you don't get any terribly good results. So slightly curious recent development, Andre Sapir wrote this sort of semi-official agenda for a growing Europe, the first of which is the way to grow in Europe is to be more like America and liberalise markets, and that's the digested read of the report. But even they end up saying that if you can roughly characterise social models across the EU in these four terms, the Anglo-Saxon model, which is essentially Britain and Ireland, the continental model is sort of classic German, Benelux countries, France, and the Mediterranean models, it's Spain, Portugal, Italy-ish, sort of, as well as the Nordic model. They end up saying that the Nordic model is actually an efficient, effective model. It actually combines equity and efficiency. It's very much the same story that, the continental Mediterranean models are inefficient and unsustainable. But the Nordic model becomes an alternative which is held up as being viable, and to the extent to which you value equity, is a rather desirable one. And the OECD report, I think, updated its 1994 job strategy, which was labour market flexibility is the way to go, and product and labour market flexibility is the way to go. And so you get this story that when product markets have been liberalised to something like the single European market. As an aside, by the way, Denmark, not surprising, Denmark has always been praised by the European Commission as the country that has implemented most single European market directives. Mm. So it's been given a pat on the back for this. So if you get products, pronounced product market flexibility and liberalisation through things like single European market, and it doesn't seem to be doing much for unemployment, well, that's because you haven't liberalised your labour markets. And if you liberalise your labour markets and don't get much traction unemployed, well, that's because product markets still need to be liberalised. The usual story. But even the OECD updating their sort of mid-90s job strategy end up saying one road is clearly the labour product market flexibility road, the Anglo-Saxon road. Another way combines flexibility with security is, yes, been talking about the flex-security model, which is more expensive. So this is more direct. I mean, Sapir just fleshed this out. The expenses, so it become a public sector expense, and you have to have the social agreements to accept the tax and spend burden of this. But the story has now become less that it's around systems of wage bargaining necessary with an investment effort. It's about active labour market policies, which I find slightly curious disjuncture between the micro and the macro story. And I think it's ultimately barking up the wrong tree to a considerable extent, because a lot of the micro-act evidence on active labour market policies isn't, well, it's mixed, it's not desperately supportive. Now, there's a macro story here that somehow what's going on in these countries is they've got effective active labour market policies which allow more egalitarian outcomes, because it's less about allowing floors on wages to fall to price low-skilled workers into jobs. And it's more about retraining workers, providing security so that they can be retrained, matched with new jobs and so on. And say, that's the kind of macro story. I'm not sure the micro story really makes sense. And so much of the active labour market literature isn't desperately supportive, and I just think it's buying up the wrong tree. Now, what's really important is what's happened since the Great Recession. We'll see the basic panning out of the numbers in a moment. There are huge variations in how far countries have suffered losses of output, but also what implications that's had for changes in unemployment. One effect of which is the great EU-US unemployment gap has now disappeared. Unemployment rates are about the same rate between the US and the EU-15. And European unemployment rates, as Jesperin pointing out, had actually been falling for quite some years before the downturn. It's a distinct improvement in EU performance, alongside a relatively strong performance about Nordic countries. What's more complicated to investigate is how far the relatively good performers share relative success stories, share common determinants, and indeed I think the evidence suggests that they don't, and there's important differences between the Nordic performance and the rest. The other key interesting feature for this, where this pans out, is not only that if historically, a financial crisis has been typically associated with particularly large and persistent rises in unemployment. But as Jesper was noticing, these countries, and particularly Finland and Sweden, to some extent Norway as well, experienced in the early 1990s very major crises. A number of estimates, Finland and Sweden probably experienced greater proportionate loss of output in the early 90s downturn than they did in the 1930s Great Depression, possibly partly because Sweden was running prototype Keynesian policies in response to the 30s Depression. And it was a banking crisis that involved, as a measure, particularly in Sweden, the government taking positions in banks that were effectively bankrupt on the assumption that pumping capital into them and getting them back up to working entities would allow the government to liquidate their position at a later date without over the course of that experiment it actually costing the government money. Once the banking system was reconstructed, reconfigured, normal circumstances had returned, essentially having taken a position when the banks were rock bottom, you could then liquidate it at a much higher value at a later date. And this is clearly what the British government, when the crisis first hit, the plan that they took off the shelf. Anyway, so this is it. This is peak to trough. I should have a better slide when I crush these both onto the same page. But this is peak to trough change in unemployment. This is probably not the most up-to-date. It's probably a few months ago. It's probably a bit more data. Germany's actually seen some marginal fall in unemployment since the start of the Great Recession. Norway, only a very small rise. Sweden, fairly small rise. Finland, somewhere in the middle. Huge rise in the United States, United Kingdom, and particularly Ireland and Spain. And if you remember, because that's in order, so the same countries, same order of countries across the bottom, and the relationship decline in output, of course, is all over the place. Germany's seen fairly strong fall in output, actual fall in unemployment rates.
But you will see Finland and Denmark and
Finland, absolutely huge losses of output in this down. This downturn, it's not the one before. Absolutely huge losses of output, fairly large losses in Denmark, absolutely in Finland and Sweden, without having anything like the impact of unemployment. The Irish and Spanish case is quite interesting if we go back. Ireland and Spain, about the same increases in unemployment. Spain on half the fall in output that Ireland has experienced. So Spain's really bad in this. So what's going on here? Typically the worst cases have been those that either had strong trade surpluses or housing market, in particularly large housing market imbalances. So the main major transmission mechanism that's gone here has been through either classic collapse in the housing market or countries exposed to the external sector. Seeing particularly bad knock-on effects from declines in world trade. The housing market imbalance is also particularly associated with rises in the budget deficits as a result of this. While high welfare expenditure is kind of ponds onto some of the questions we raised in Jesper's points that I want to come on to, are not particularly associated with rises in government debt positions. And rather oddly, there's no particularly strong evidence, as far as we can get data on, to suggest that there's a relationship between countries' exposure to US toxic assets. We're saying that essentially this was a US-generated crisis. A crisis generates in the US system. And you might expect, therefore, the differences in countries' banks' exposure to US toxic assets would have some bearing on the degree of crisis in that country's financial system. That doesn't seem to work at all. Now, how do we explain this unemployment response? The standard attempt to do this has been to fit various kinds of Oaken's law explanations so that there is some sort of relationship by how much unemployment changes for a given change, in this particular case, a given fall in the level of output. And so when you work on historic data of what's been the past patterns of relationship in changes, short-run changes in output and changes in unemployment, actually, this gives us rather little traction. We might expect the more flexible labour markets are, the more elastic the relationship is, so that possibly more flexible labour markets give short-run spikes in unemployment. It's harder and more expensive to sack people in more protected labour markets, but the downside is the bounce back creates more employment once the economy turns its point. But this doesn't actually seem to get a terribly strong traction this fall. So there's a fairly weak relationship to any of this in the standard labour market, institutional variables, the legal system, trade unions, and so on. And as I said, this is part of a more general that I think now this sort of notion that we can get a handle on just after somebody's won the Nobel Prize for explaining unemployment precisely in these terms, for various kind of real and econometric issues, I think the more generally we're starting to look at the limitations of using these sort of institutional variables to explain unemployment relations. Further, even if you do run it on historic data and say, well, historically, on average, if a country went into a downturn, X percent fall in output led to Y percent rise in unemployment. Even if you take that sort of data, whatever was explaining why one country's elasticity was so much greater or less than another's, this crisis does seem to be importantly different. There's not a terribly strong relationship between actual change in unemployment and actual change in output. Although a number of measures in this, there seems to be much less rise in unemployment in the Nordic economies in response to this downturn, even given past priors of what elasticities were, than one might expect. So they do appear to, whichever way you cut it, to be doing relatively well. Now, the standard presumed mechanisms here, and one of the interesting things about this is this is not what really seems to be the story of Nordic economies at the moment. The standard presumed mechanisms are that there are certain incentives for firms to hoard labour in response to a downturn. Part of this may be where you have these more less flexible labour markets. So if you have employment protection legislation, it's more expensive, difficult, takes longer to get rid of people. Less institutionally, there's the question of firm-specific human capital. Is it actually worth getting rid of people when, come the next upturn, you'll have to rehire people, hire new people, train them up and go, and so on. The risk of all this, if you do have labour hoarding under these circumstances, is it looks okay in the short run, but if and when, when the economy recovers, you risk a jobless growth scenario. Productivity falls as output falls, but you keep the same, as virtually as a matter of definition. If output's falling, you're producing less with less demand, but retaining much of the workforce, then labour productivity is going to fall. And unit labour costs are likely therefore to rise. So when the recovery comes along, you simply activate the workforce that you have been working on short-time working, but you don't get much net growth in employment. So as some people will lose their jobs, some firms will go under. The recovery may be rather weak in generating growth at the end of this. Now, this does seem to work in some countries like Germany, where there is clearly being instigated various forms of established short-time working arrangements. What doesn't, interesting, is it does not appear to be happening in the Nordic countries, where there's much more dynamic adjustment in the labour inflows and outflows. The Nordic countries seem to be consistent with the story that there are people losing jobs, but there are also people gaining jobs. There are flows into the unemployment pool and flows out of the unemployment pool. Whereas countries like Germany, where other countries where you've had minimal change, what seems to be going on is there's very little movement either way. Relatively few people, given the falls of output, are actually being made unemployed because there's some sort of labour hoarding short-time working effect. There aren't many jobs being created on the other side either. It's a fairly static pool. The Nordic countries' labour markets appear to be rather much more dynamic, with much stronger flows into unemployment. So people are losing their jobs, but stronger flows outside from the other side. So it seems to be much more effective at actually shifting labour from one area to another. Now, if I knew the magic answer to that, then I'd be very happy. As I don't, I'll rattle through this because this is the sort of roughly the story that Jesper has already suggested. A number of these economies doing better, or if it's no worse than the euro area, the euro 15 average. And although employment population rates are dipping a bit, still maintaining relatively high employment population rates, so relatively high levels of employment, relatively high employment rates, as we've already discussed, of employment of of in particular women workers, and as you were mentioning over there, relatively high rates of employment of older workers. I mean, crudely speaking, the groups that tend to suffer in these economies that have relatively low employment population rates are the young and the old. And this frequently doesn't show up on unemployment statistics. There are ways of parking people at the very young, so in the British acronym of NEETS, not in employment, education or training, and the very old, the 50 plus, in schemes that take them off the unemployment registers. But it still shows up, of course, in these employment population figures. Now, here's the interesting thing, which comes back to some of the points that Jesper was raising puzzles earlier. There does seem to be a systematic negative relationship between prior levels of social expenditure and the change in the debt-GDP ratio since the onset of the crisis. And very crudely, the story that... admit there's an element of squint and you missed it at this, but I think there is some, I think there's some sort of action and traction going on this story. A number of people have started to comment on this, that the countries with high existing past social expenditure levels seem to be associated with less increase in the debt GDP ratios, and those countries with relatively low social expenditures prior hand have seen the really big increases in debt GDP ratios. And one of the slides Jesper had earlier, the change in the budget deficit, particularly in Sweden, but a bit less so in Denmark, but particularly in Sweden over the crisis, has not been that great. The budget deficit is not that huge. And I think the story goes here, it's around the sort of security aspects that Jesper was talking about. The cushioning effects of this, first of all, it will operate to some extent to stabilise aggregate demand anyway through automatic stabilisation means. But the security aspect changes the wider political economy of this. The security protection this provides, in a wider political economy sense, could be hypothesised to reduce the kind of instant pressure to do something. Faced with a crisis, governments are forced to do something to implement breakneck Keynesian policies, in the loose sense of the term, expansionary fiscal policy, and indeed implement breakneck expansionary monetary policies, quantitative easing and so on, the effects of which is far from clear thus far that it's been particularly effective. These automatic cushioning and security systems actually do seem to be quite effective at cushioning the economy and resisting demands for very sudden major changes in policy, which, whilst preferable to governments like the UK doing and the US doing nothing in response to it, I mean, clearly I think that would have made the situation worse. Nevertheless, sudden big changes in macro policy undertaking very short periods of time may not actually be terribly efficient or effective ways of doing this. So this seems actually to be a more balanced adjustment path. The provisional implications, and here I think this time at least we're going to, Jesper and I will probably largely agree on this. The labour markets have worked relatively well in these Nordic countries, contrary to much of the sort of critical commentary that until recently, I was emphasised there's been a change in fashion, until recently it's been very critical of them, trade unions were too strong, taxes were too high and so on. Also, the financial systems have worked remarkably well. The post-early 1990s crisis reforms implementing these financial systems actually seem to have made them pretty robust compared to, do I need to fill in the blanks for certain other countries? The official OECD reports, the OECD and so on, are still getting rather sniffy, as they always are, about it. It's a relentless negativity. Now we see here reports about Scandinavian economies. The demeanour of a 19th century undertow. It's like reading something out of Dickens. They can always find a fault somewhere, no matter how well these economies are doing. And predictably suggest wage rights are running too high. There should be further decentralisation of the wage bargaining system, dismantling of the national norms wage bargaining systems, which themselves are much more decentralised than they were sort of 20 years ago. Despite the fact that, at least so far, there's pretty limited evidence that the wage growth, which is even the OECD would concede has helped keep demand through private consumption reasonably buoyant. There's not very compelling evidence thus far it's been that effective. And at least if you've got certain tools of macro policy autonomy, this may still be effective, and indeed it may be a test case for whether wage-led growth is really possible. I don't want to go too long into these models in the time available, but this is the notion. I'm ambivalent about this. The theories here, but it's popular the last time I was discussing this, that growth could be either wage-led or profit-led. In a sense, either can go either way. If income shifts from wages to profits, then wage earners tend to spend more than profit holders, so that will boost aggregate demand for consumption, but reduce incentives for investment. If you do it the other way, if you shift income from wages to profits, that could encourage investment by expanding profitability, but as profit earners tend to spend less, then it may have dampening aggregate demand effects. So in principle, it could go either way, and in principle, you can work out whether countries are wage-led or profit-led. And so I'm rather ambivalent about whether that theory has much traction, but this could yet be a test case of whether wage-led growth is really possible. But coming back to on a firmer ground, the fiscal stabilisers, I think, have been effective in putting up what we were discussing earlier. And this has reduced the reliance that appears to have in other countries in breakneck, either expansionary fiscal policies or breakneck monetary policy, to the extent that both Norway and Sweden latterly have moved to some tightening of monetary policy in response to possibilities of inflationary pressures kicking through. There, both cases, the property market starting to recover and property prices starting to rise again. So that the strength of their economies and ability to rise this adjustment is such that central bankers are always concerned that we can see inflationary pressures almost anywhere. But to the extent to which there are real grounds for believing that there may even need to be some cooling off, whilst the rest of the world is still worrying about how on earth it's going to boost itself out of this scenario. One implication of which, again, rather going on, overlapping with what Jesper is saying, is that there may well continue to be a potential viable role for macro policy autonomy on both monetary and fiscal fronts. So on all sorts of grounds, this has been poo-pooed, the greater move towards the Eurozone, the belief that in a globalised economy there's somehow no role for macro policy autonomy anywhere, you don't have any freedom for manoeuvre. In practice, the whole thrust of kind of intellectual and policy development for the last 20 years seems to suggest that there's no real traction for macro policy autonomy, and therefore you might as well give it up through mechanisms like, in particular, the euro area. I think the fashion for that may be changing a bit, and indeed I think part of the ability Norway has had in this is that Norway has both a different inflation target from the ECB. It's slightly, marginally higher, not dramatically different, but it's slightly higher. But it's also more flexible in terms of its interpretation, the possibility for allowing some emphasis on output stabilisation as well as inflation stabilisation. It's allowed you to run macro policies in the context of structures that I think are robust. There's a lot more I could say about the structures in these economies, but it's getting late. And the nutshell of which, for all the longer term problems of these economies, which I could talk about in questioning if people want to more, and particularly investment effort, the macro policy regimes and the structures of these high tax, high spend economies are remarkably robust, and so I shall end there.